This is the Takeaway Podcast for Thursday, June 23rd, 2016.
This is the Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Is it smart to live in a city? All that traffic, that congestion. Is it dumb to be caught in this urban gridlock? Billions of people jammed together in a post-industrial 21st century mass?
We don't presume to know all the answers. In fact, we're counting on the cooperation of American industry to provide their very best thinking during the planning and the creation of our experimental prototype community of tomorrow.
That's better. The reassuring voice of Walt Disney talking about his city of the future. What a vision. He sounds like a smart fellow speaking back there in the 1960s about what in part became Epcot Center in Florida's Disney World. Why haven't all cities turned out that way? Or are they about to? This may just be the closest thing to Disney and other urban futurists' vision being delivered today in New York City. Hudson Yards on the west side of Manhattan, named for the railroad tracks it's being constructed over. 30 tracks that have rumbled and served passengers and commuters for more than a century. It made modern New York when they were first laid back in the 1800s. On top of all that, and beneath a dozen cranes, a new city within a city is rising.
So looking at the eastern rail yards, immediately in front of us is a blue crane. That'll be 15 Hudson Yards, the first residential building. Behind it is the culture shed. It will also have a retractable shed.
It's the biggest private real estate development in U.S. history, but more than that, it claims to be a model for the 21st century urban experience. Public schools sitting next to major corporation offices, parkgoers, and affordable housing units all together next to curated restaurants and superstores overlooked by what will soon be some of the most valued property in New York City. This is the smart city of the present that aims to define the future for all of us. And people have already been voting with their feet all over the world for the urban experience. Can 55% of the world's population that lives in cities right now be wrong? That's a number that's expected to rise to 66% by 2050 and over 85% of the world's population by the end of the 21st century. Meeting that need with an eye for economic growth, backed by solid infrastructure, reliable public health, all in a way that addresses climate change, this bold new vision declares that planned, intentional cities are smart and possible.
Smart. It's what our cities should be.
That's right, smart cities. A vision taking shape here in New York and its advocates hope in every population center in the world.
In a megacity world, countries can be suburbs of cities.
We once built cities around harbors and railroads. Picture Boston's cobblestones or Chicago's skyscrapers. But what kind of city do you get in a global world? One where New York is closer to Hong Kong than to Buffalo. You get a city built around the airport. This is the Aerotropolis, a city with an airport at its center, the better to keep the global economy aloft.
This is actually a good moment to think enthusiastically and cautiously about the city of the future. 2016 is the centennial of the urban critic and mother of modern urban planning, Jane Jacobs, who warned long ago about grandiose developers peddling their urban vision.
This is one of the troubles with what I call the vision thing. The vision thing is an idea that somewhere or other in the future is a golden age that we should be working toward. And when we get it, boy, won't that be great.
The late Jane Jacobs represents a voice for human-scale development. Skeptical of cranes and billion-dollar budgets, she believed cities can't ever trade their street-level spontaneity for glass and steel sterility. The federal government and the Department of Transportation are both hoping to encourage intelligent solutions that achieve a balance of these when they announce the winner of their Smart Cities Challenge, issuing a grant of about $40 million. Technologies from Google and Amazon to one of seven finalists, communities from all around the nation. New York's Hudson Yards has seen plenty of public money, but it isn't close to finished. It has already changed this forlorn urban netherworld, with more to come.
We're going to raise it. We're going to raise it about 12 feet so that in 2018 you're going to be able to walk all the way from Ganswort Street up to Times Square on green parkland.
So you just raise it, lower it, you know, it's no big deal to you.
It's a little bit more complicated than that, but in order to do that, we have to bring the street up.
That's Jessica Scaparotti, an executive with the related company that's developing Hudson Yards. She's not like you or me. When she looks at streets and brick, she imagines moving it all around like clay, fashioning it to be
the quintessential live, work, play environment. When Hudson Yards is complete in 2025, you're going to have 125,000 people a day that either work in, live in, or visit Hudson Yards. That's tremendous.
Of all incomes, or is it just sort of luxury, luxury, luxury?
No, all incomes. We will have affordable housing on site. Something most people don't know about Related is that the company was actually founded building affordable housing, and we have an entire division that focuses on affordable housing, and we believe that's an important part of any city.
But what's this city really built on?
Miles and miles of fiber capacity, a lot of connectivity between the buildings.
You're literally building Hudson Yards from the internet up. And the internet itself is all about connectivity. And therefore, we're going to see an unprecedented level of digital connectivity, both within Hudson Yards and in terms of its relationship to the wider world.
Those are the voices of Jay Cross and Dan Doctoroff, two of the project's main creators. What will all that fiber carry? Data from 120,000 daily residents and workers in the world's first quantified community. A neighborhood's worth of data and moving parts on every level. For trash collection, for instance, there will be pneumatic tubes running underground. There will be tightly monitored water and energy usage. The city creates its own power with a cogeneration plant, and it will monitor its own health 24/7. Smart city technology, a concept that's been around for the last decade or so. Anthony Townsend is author of Smart Cities, Big Data, Civic Hackers, and the Quest for a New Utopia.
The word smart cities kind of gets thrown around a lot and at times can touch a whole bunch of different progressive ideas about how to design cities or govern them better. We've always had technology to solve problems. But digital technology is a new set of tools that we have that are very versatile, and they're changing and growing and becoming more capable every day.
And so Jay Cross, president of Related Hudson Yards, sets out to make the most technologically responsive neighborhood in the United States.
We realized it's not just about connectivity and it's not just about resiliency. It's about user experiences and creating an environment in which whatever the user experience du jour is can be implemented quickly and efficiently. Once you start to engage in that sort of infrastructure building, once the systems are talking together, now you've got an opportunity to, oh, so now I've got a lot more data. Then the whole world of opportunity starts to present itself. And so when we start to blue sky what we think can happen at Hudson Yards, we've come up with over 100 user experiences that can range from keyless entry to your apartment and, you know, controlling your nanny cams to having a VIP arrive at your office and have them escorted seamlessly to your office in a safe and secure way, and everything in between.
Safe and secure and with big money, too. Estimates 3 years ago were that the smart city data-driven economy would be worth about $100 billion annually by 2020. Those estimates immediately ballooned to $408 billion, and now the latest estimate is $1.56 trillion annually by 2020. Google wants in, of course. Sidewalk Labs is essentially their subsidiary. It's run by Daniel Doctoroff today, who gave the Hudson Yards its name when he was deputy mayor of New York with Michael Bloomberg. To Doctoroff, Hudson Yards is history.
We are sort of in a new era, and we're just beginning to realize how powerful it might be. You know, if you look back over the last couple hundred years in cities, there have been three major sort of technological revolutions in cities. You know, one was the steam engine in the early part of the 1800s that brought people to cities, industrialized them, made modern sanitation possible. A second was the introduction and adoption of the electric grid, which made cities vertical, made them 24-hour, and made modern communication possible. The third was the automobile, which had a much more decidedly mixed impact on cities. But we're at the dawn of a fourth, and that really is one where you see a set of technologies that are converging all at one moment. We're all connected. We're connected with high-speed fiber networks, with smartphones,
things are changing because we now have the ability to monitor things through location services and sensors and other things in real time. Computing power and the intelligence of computers is growing, and that is literally going to change almost everything that occurs in cities, from the way we move around to the infrastructure we build to the buildings and types of buildings that we create. Ultimately, it's going to affect the way we govern and interact with each other, as well as sort of the set of social programs like education and public safety and health that are so fundamental to society. And we believe that when you actually look at all of these technologies and you begin to imagine how they play out, they offer a remarkable opportunity to meaningfully improve quality of life. It's going to be fascinating over the next several decades, because these things don't happen fast, to watch that unfold, and our mission is to help accelerate that.
Doctorov's Sidewalk Labs has traffic apps to ease congestion. There's an app called Flow, which they will donate to the winner of the Department of Transportation's Smart City Challenge. There will be Wi-Fi kiosks with built-in sensors. Google Cities coming to a city near you. Does that sound like a good idea? I'm not a guinea pig for Google, am I?
No, you're not a guinea pig for Google. We are very, very focused on kind of using technology, whether it's Hudson Yards or in other places, to improve quality of life. You know, one of the things that is core to this is figuring out how we kind of take sort of the ubiquitous connectivity and the data that gets produced and use it in ways that are both sensitive to the privacy of people, but also help them to have better lives. And that's a big part of what we're trying to do.
In your dream state, when I walk through the Hudson Yards typical streets, will the street lamps be different? Will the kiosks on the side of the sidewalk be different? Will I see anything that clearly indicates that some of this technology has been incorporated?
I think it'll certainly all feel very familiar. You know, we're not talking about a place that is going to look completely different, but the way in which you experience it, the way in which it's capable of adjusting, the way you're better able to share resources, all of those things will provide benefits over time. And so I said, it'll feel familiar, but hopefully it'll actually feel better.
I just don't think that quantification has anything to do with quality of life or what it means to be an engaged citizen of a great urban place.
That's Adam Greenfield, a new urbanist in the big data age, inspired by Jane Jacobs, who's keeping score at the beginning of this fourth era of the city.
There's very, very little that's actually neutral and objective. There are very few things where you can make an intervention and everybody universally benefits from that. There will always be some party who benefits, and there will always be some party that relatively speaking, loses out.
We'll hear from Greenfield and others who are holding developers accountable, or trying anyway. We'll hear from a community board member in New York who takes on some of the city's biggest developers. And we'll hear from a peer and disciple of Jane Jacobs. Stay tuned. This is Smart. It's The Takeaway. One way of posing the question of what constitutes a smart city is to do what the federal government did last year, just throw it wide open.
For the Smart City Challenge, imagine a city where transportation just works. Smart. It's what our cities should be. Equipped with technologies that transform our vehicles and infrastructure so that we can safely manage every aspect of our transportation system. What transportation technologies should a smart city have? Our goal is for you to determine the possible so we can move beyond traffic.
The DOT officially announced today the winner of their Smart City Challenge, which gives $40 million of federal money to a city in an attempt to become, quote, the country's first city to fully integrate innovative technologies. Self-driving cars, connected vehicles, smart sensors, all the stuff we've been talking about, into their transportation network. 78 cities submitted proposals to win this tech makeover, coming down to 7 finalists: Austin, Texas, Columbus, Ohio, Denver, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, Portland, and San Francisco. And today, the Department of Transportation officially announced that Columbus, Ohio was the winner. Andrew Ginther, welcome to The Takeaway. Mayor of Columbus, congratulations.
Thank you so much, John. It's a great day here in Columbus. We're excited to welcome the secretary for his big announcement today, and the city is very, very excited about moving forward with our Smart Columbus program.
How does this feel? I mean, I guess you must feel like that fellow up in Westerville last year who won $200 million in the lottery. I mean, that, you know, he's got a lot more zeros than you do, but how are you feeling?
Well, the great part about it is this local community, we went about this proposal and program the Columbus Way, based on our great track record of public-private partnerships here in this community. So even though it's $40 million from the DOT, $10 million from Vulcan, we've been able to secure $90 million in growing of local match. So we're going to put $140 million-plus to work implementing the Smart Columbus program. You know, we're proud and humbled to have been chosen from so many great American cities. Austin, Denver, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, Portland, San Francisco are all great American cities and have great mayors. The secretary was very clear with this. This is not just about one city and one program. His intention and the vision of Paul Allen from Vulcan was to have one of our cities serve as a lab for intelligent transportation system and take the lessons learned and best practices to cities and share them across the country. So we're excited to play that role for the country.
What do you think the first thing is that people will see in Columbus that's going to really show how far ahead this is going to put you, and you know, what's it going to look like?
Well, I think one of the first things they're going to see is a focus on integration and safety of everything from traffic signals and using technology and information to help folks better navigate the city. I think they're also going to see one of the big focuses for us has been about helping to connect the disconnected. So even though we have the fastest growing economy in the Midwest, lowest unemployment in 25 years, you know, a very strong, thriving economy, we know that not every family and every neighborhood shared in that success. And so Linden in particular is a neighborhood just to the east of where I live, but they have three times higher infant mortality rates, higher concentrations of poverty, violent crime, but they're only one neighborhood away from one of the largest job centers in central Ohio up at Easton. And so part of our pilot for Linden, the median income there is some $10,000, $12,000 less than the median income from the region. One of the things that we're going to be focused on is using our Smart Columbus program to help with that first mile, last mile for access to jobs, higher education, healthcare, fresh fruits and vegetables. It's also a food desert there in Linden. And then our intention is to use that model and take it to other neighborhoods throughout the city to make sure that more families in more neighborhoods are sharing the success story that is Columbus.
Can you elaborate, Mayor, on that first mile, last mile concept? Because it's really critical to the delivery of all kinds of services. And even though this is about transportation, there's a first mile, last mile issue in almost every aspect of life nowadays.
Well, and I think one of the reasons that Columbus was selected for many different reasons were the test market capital of the United States. I mean, whether it's hamburgers, politics, or ice cream, if it sells in Columbus, you can sell it anywhere. And so the first mile, last mile, being able to address that here. So in Linden, we have just put in place a rapid transit line through the Transit Authority that goes up and down Cleveland Avenue to the Easton Town Center. But we got to get folks to that line. And then once they arrive at Easton to their job or education opportunity, affordable, high-quality childcare, and healthcare options that are at Easton. And so we're going to be using autonomous vehicles. We're going to be using, you know, ride share, bike share. So kind of a seamless way for the people of Linden to tackle the first mile, last mile to get to opportunities.
It's fascinating stuff. I wonder if you'll permit me to just brainstorm with you a little bit. You could, I happen to work in the disability community a lot, and you could pilot a driverless vehicle paratransit system in Ohio, in Columbus, and really just learn a whole lot about, you know, transit systems of all kinds, even though you'd be serving a very underserved community as well.
Absolutely. And folks that have been part of our planning, our community outreach, I mean, I think that's one of the things that really sold the secretary on Columbus as well is the way that the community has come together. So it's whether, you know, environmentalists, transit option, disability advocates have all been part of this process. And obviously the private sector and institutions of higher education that all came together. You know, there are a lot of communities that have great resources. But really, the whole point of this is it's so much more than moving people from point A to point B. How does transportation help to improve people's lives? And, you know, it gets to the crux of the question for all of us for the 21st century. How do we leverage and harness innovation and technology to help empower people to improve their own lives? And so that's the crux of our work here with Smart Columbus, and that's why we're so excited about today's announcement with the Secretary.
One bone to pick with you, though, Mayor.
Okay.
I mean, Columbus is a great place. I'm born in Dayton. I know the cities of Ohio. Don't you feel that you're just kind of, I mean, Akron, Cleveland, LeBron James, I mean, this was their week. And look at you coming in and bigfooting them all. Bigfooting LeBron and the NBA champions. I mean, come on.
No, there is no way that any announcement would big dog the king and the great city of Cleveland. I am thrilled for Mayor Jackson. But today is Columbus's day.
Thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thanks again, John. Appreciate you having us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding research so patients do more than survive, they live their lives. Learn more at lls.org. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
This is the Takeaway Smart Cities program all hour long. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Progress in the 20th century city was driven by electricity, by railroads and cars.
Right down the main line of progress.
The 21st century city demands something else, data, and lots of it. Constantine Kondakosta's job is to manage it and make sure it's useful. He's professor of urban informatics and head of the Quantified Community Research Lab at NYU's Center for Urban Science and Progress. It's part of the Tandon School of Engineering. It's a new type of public-private academic research institution to foster a new era of city living. Kondakosta says that data collection isn't just about transportation or taking out the trash. It's becoming a factor in all aspects of city life.
There is, of course, one use of the data just in better understanding how a neighborhood or a building or a community is actually functioning. So what is working? How are people getting to and from the community? What are they doing while they're there? And thus being able to make the processes more efficient for people who are trying to get in and around a development like Hudson Yards. The other, of course, is providing more direct services to the people who are living there and working there. So you can imagine a situation, for instance, where you have a connected environment where someone has an app for the neighborhood, where it knows where that person is because of a GPS signal from the phone. As they get close to their office, the elevator comes down, is ready for them, is pre-programmed to the floor they're going to go to. As they go up, the phone signals how close they are to their office. They power up their computer, they power up the AC. So this provides not only a unique experience for the worker in that case, but also efficiencies in terms of operational costs.
Is it fair to say that this is the first community, Hudson Yards, that presumes a cell phone basically in the possession of virtually every resident?
That's a great question. I mean, obviously this is, you know, the ubiquity of cell phones and these types of devices is completely changing how we're experiencing cities. And I think, you know, Hudson Yards and these types of large-scale modern developments that are starting to occur in Chicago and Philadelphia, starting to see some of this happening, and certainly other parts of the world, where the idea of embedding this type of infrastructure to support data collection and data analysis, and then also recognizing that how this user engagement, in a way, or citizen engagement of how people are interacting with space is changing dramatically, and that developers need to account for that.
You know, a lot of people who talk about the old 100-year-old Jan Jacobs ideas and the urban planning ideas and the suspicion of some of the modern technological architecture that we see in the cities always speak of this spontaneous urban moment where people are on the streets and looking at each other and there's diversity and anything can happen. There's all kinds of surprises. It would be sad if the technology ends up being an excuse for everyone to stay in their offices that much more and get stuff delivered to them. How is this technology and the use of this data going to preserve that kind of spontaneous on-the-street experience, and is there any thought of that?
I think in terms of the general line of research that we're doing, I mean, one of the things we're trying to better understand is, you know, what Lewis Mumford before Jane Jacobs called the urban drama and what Jane Jacobs called the street ballet. In some cases, we want to understand really how does that work? Can we begin to measure that in some objective way? And I think largely there's a lot of things in there that are very difficult to quantify and to measure. There's no question about that. But we can really understand what activates a street corner or what activates a public park. So the way I'm viewing this is very much we have much greater technology to be able to understand those interactions and that behavior. You know, we have cell phones, we have other sensors that are now very low cost but very accurate. So we could really do a much better understanding, a job of understanding how a city, how a neighborhood, how its design, how its structure ultimately impacts human behavior.
Constantine Contacosta, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Constantine Contacosta is professor of urban informatics and head of the Quantified Community Research Lab at NYU.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, working to help Americans navigate the legal system. With assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents, legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
We're going to hear from a solidly contrary voice now. New Yorker Adam Greenfield is the founder and managing editor of the human-oriented urban planning firm Urban Scale. He's the author of Against the Smart City, hence contrarian. He worries about the top-down development and alarming-sounding issues like predictive policing, the embedded sensors and looped fibers. He's wary of what smart city developments like Hudson Yards mean for the spontaneous street scenes that he's come to love in New York.
I just don't think that quantification has anything to do with quality of life or what it means to be an engaged citizen of a great urban place. What we see is that the people who are framing these visions really do perceive urban life as fundamentally being about security and convenience and safety and consumption. And even if we buy that these things are part and parcel of urban experience, which I don't, they tend to reserve those prerogatives for only a very few. And everybody else in the city is sort of treated as a material for the generation of data with which to feed the prerogatives of security and safety and consumption. Beyond that, it indicates to me that public and private agencies both are increasingly empowered to act on that in ways that I don't think our public discourse has really begun to reckon with.
Do you think there's a benefit to having computer-controlled lighting and lighting that keeps track of foot traffic and determines when lights need to come on, when they need to go off, that alert people about traffic conditions, that sort of thing? Is technology ever an answer in making cities better?
When we think of anything as complex and contested as a great metropolitan place, as one of the great cities of Earth, it's amazing that when you drill into just about any state of affairs, there's very, very little that's actually neutral and objective. There are very few things where you can make an intervention and everybody universally benefits from that. There will always be some party who benefits, and there will always be some party that relatively speaking, loses out. And what I find dishonest about the smart city rhetoric is that it almost always asserts that there are general or universal benefits. And I think that there are organizations that, for commercial gain, are proposing to deploy these systems in our cities. And I do not often think they're particularly forthright about the complete set of circumstances that they present the communities with into which they are deployed.
What's an alternative? I mean, with the idea that technology will be employed, that the cities will pay for it, and that things like, you know, 311 lines for information for citizens are viewed as democratizing, what do you think is an appropriate way to proceed?
Well, I would prefer to see investment in the fundamental infrastructures of daily life. I mean, I think that it's sort of a shame that in the States anymore we don't really do public funding of infrastructure. And it feels a little bit like a sideshow to me that we're claiming to be able to have the latest and the greatest, but our bridges and our highways and our streets are falling apart.
Finally, Adam, you refer to spontaneous enjoyment of urban space as though it were a scenario that particularly delights you. What are you talking about, and what is it you would most not want to lose in the New York or city of your best memories?
You know, that's a beautiful question. Jane Jacobs talks gorgeously about what she calls the sidewalk ballet, this sort of spontaneous mixture of different kinds of people from different backgrounds, different walks of life, intermingling on the sidewalks of New York City. And to my mind, that is fundamentally what cities are about. Cities are an engine to expose us to difference, and we grow by way of our exposure to that difference. What truly concerns me about the smart city rhetoric is the degree to which it divides us into market segments, and it allows us to shrink ever further into the confines of cognitive and social bubbles. You know, with all due respect, if you want to live that way, then go live in the suburbs. That's not what cities are for. That's not what cities do for us. To deploy technologies that begin to erode that diversity and mixture is to undermine the very value proposition of a great city.
Adam Greenfield is the founder and managing director of Urban Scale. He's the author of Against the Smart City. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
One way of posing the question of what constitutes a smart city is to do what the federal government did last year. Just throw it wide open.
For the Smart City Challenge, imagine a city where transportation just works. Smart. It's what our cities should be. Equipped with technologies that transform our vehicles and infrastructure so that we can safely manage every aspect of our transportation system. What transportation technologies should a smart city have? Our goal is for you to determine the possible so we can move beyond traffic.
The Department of Transportation officially announces the winner today in their Smart City Challenge, which will give $40 million of federal money to one city in an attempt to become, quote, the country's first city to fully integrate innovative technology, self-driving cars, connected vehicles, and smart sensors into their transportation network.
I like to think of it as a choreography.
Anthony Townsend, author of Smart Cities, Big Data, Civic Hackers, and the Quest for a New Utopia, who also served as an advisor to the government's Smart Cities Challenge on what a fully connected city might look like.
We're all kind of relying on these services to choreograph very complicated lives in very complicated places. And when those things don't work, you know, this is what I think people were feeling when they reacted to kind of Soviet bureaucracy and standing in lines and all the red tape, and why American-style capitalism was so much better because we had freedom of choice and flexibility. It's the exact same thing. It's just another degree of separation. And, you know, when we look back at people standing in line to get things instead of just ordering ahead and picking it up, it seems that archaic to us.
That vision of a Soviet-free tomorrow means lots of donated technology from big tech companies like Amazon and Google, as well as an additional $10 million in funding from Paul Allen's Vulcan Company. But the United States is not really a global leader in the smart city movement.
It's happening all around the world right now.
A number of cities in China and South Korea, like Songdo, have been made in the top-down smart city mold. And then there's the smaller, more informal developments in urban centers, which Townsend calls the dark matter of the movement.
I think the most exciting thing from my point of view is that this technology, while it's global, you know, the iPhone that you buy is the same iPhone that someone that walks into a, you know, store in Dubai or in Johannesburg buys. But the things that they do with it and the apps that they might download to live in that city and thrive in that city are completely different. You know, there's something like 570,000 local governments around the world. And they're all solving problems differently using technology. It's particularly in the big, booming megacities of the global south where there really haven't been functioning urban governments, in squatter communities where people don't even have formal legal right to be on the land that they're on, that they're basically just inventing these things on the fly and many times, you know, using technology to do the most basic rudimentary things like make a map of what their community looks like. And there's a whole field of what they call slum mapping that uses cameras mounted on balloons and GPS trackers and on phones. And people go out and they map their own community to kind of bring it into the formal fold of planning and allow themselves to kind of become part of the political system.
What works and doesn't work in your city? And what would you yell at City Hall about? Does your city need more driverless cars and buses that speak to each other? New Jersey. I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey. I loved that everywhere I looked, I saw people like me. I heard people like me, and by me, I mean Latino. I did not know the feeling of being a minority until I went to Rutgers University, which is also one of the most diverse universities in the nation. What needs to work better is the growing amount of crime. The city is constantly in the news for shootings, muggings, etc., with no relief in sight.
My name is Liz Ritter. I live in Washington Heights, New York City. I love that our neighborhood banded together with a coalition of community groups and the local community board in partnership with our elected officials to save our local supermarket from closing and being replaced by a big box chain drugstore. And we still have our neighborhood supermarket. Margaret Mead was right. Never doubt that a small, committed group of citizens can change the world.
More on how community boards and citizens groups can make an impact in the new age of the city later in the show. This is The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
For all of her long career as an urban theorist and planner, Jane Jacobs insisted that the best measure of the health of a city was how it worked at street level.
If people get fond of their district, their neighborhood, and stay there, and if the city is working the way it should, they begin to get connections in the next generation to get better educations and so on. And all of this is reflected in the neighborhood.
Sustainable development, Jane Jacobs argued all of her life, is just nurturing a quality of life in the heart of the city, which to her is the neighborhood. To old hands in the city of New York, this concept of the smart city is not so new, therefore. It's just another way of thinking about change. Roberta Brandis-Gratz is an urban planner, founder of the Center for the Living City, and author of We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City.
It's always a moment to think about change and things happening that are changing. The fundamentals don't change, though. The new flavor of the moment might make people think that there's all sorts of change happening that is momentary. I think there is a major difference today because technology is certainly playing a role that it hasn't in a long time. But I'm amused to look back at the time when the cell phone was the newest thing and everybody said, well, between cell phones and computers, cities will just be an anachronism. We won't need them anymore. And yet the first thing that happened when computers came out and cell phones, and mostly computers, was the Internet Cafe. People need people, and that's what cities are about. And whatever technology you embrace, you're not going to lose, or you shouldn't lose, the essence of a city, which is the interconnection of people and place.
What would Jane Jacobs think about the Smart Cities Initiative and the idea that technology is going to reclaim some of this territory taken by cars?
Well, first of all, it's always dangerous to try to assume what Jane Jacobs would say. Although we did have discussions about some of this before she died, it was never at this point. First of all, her whole notion was regain the city for transit and for feet, not for cars. And she used to say she wasn't against cars. She was against remaking the city to accommodate cars. And that if people chose the inconvenience of sitting in traffic in their car, that was their choice. But don't ask us to give up what makes the city urban to be accommodating to the car. And she was very articulate in how when we fought over Westway, that Westway was about trading in the money for transit, not expanding our capacity to bring in new vehicular traffic.
Westway, the imagined interstate highway that would be on the west side.
Yeah, the 12 lanes of traffic that would have been, you know, partially underground and landfill and all that stuff on the far west side, which would never have happened as it was planned anyway. But the important, and I had a whole chapter based on interviews with her in my Battle for Gotham book, it was very clear that the trade-in which happened under duress. Mayors Koch and Governor Kerry traded in Westway for transit funding at the 11th hour. That funding was going to cease. And that trade-in was the beginning of the rebuilding of the New York City transit system and the region. And it has, you know, been amazing what has happened in our transit system. And that's been the lifeblood of the city. I have friends who have lived in Brooklyn for decades who will tell you that they could never get home. They could never get to and from the city in a reasonable way until the transit system was reborn. And now look at Brooklyn, look at Queens, look at the Bronx. It's amazing because the growth and the positive change has been able to spread.
What do you think of the technology, the wired and data collecting city that suddenly will have its tryout in Hudson Yards and extend elsewhere in the city where there are already cameras all over the place?
You know, I don't know that it will actually change urbanism. Urbanism is still about people, not about devices. And we're caught in that moment of excitement. There will be a lot of advantages, you know, probably access to all sorts of things will be great. But, you know, our technology is making us more of a divided society than ever. It's access to the technology that defines us and differentiates people who have access and people who don't have access. But the fundamentals of a city, the fundamentals of urbanism are not going to change.
What would you caution would be the Jane Jacobs sort of warning and lesson that we should take with us 100 years after?
Don't think that cities can be reduced to data and efficient technologies. One of the fundamental problems with planning years ago was it was always based on data, not on people. We are a people-oriented society, and that's what city is about. And I think if Jane taught us one thing, it was to observe and to understand through observation and through people and people, not through people and technology.
Roberta Brandes-Gratz is an urban planner. She's the founder of the Center for the Living City and author of We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. Thank you so much.
Good to be here.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI. By Staples, with packing, shipping, and moving supplies for both business and personal needs 7 days a week. Learn more at Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
It's worth noting here at the end of the hour that the urban planning movement got its start a long time ago, not out of an enlightened sense of how to fashion human settlements, but as a way of stopping the out-of-control expansion of urban America. In the spirit of Jane Jacobs at her centennial, and beginning with the urban political revolution of Fiorella LaGuardia in the 1930s, the people's voice would be heard regarding who could build and what could be built in New York City.
We are fighting this vicious machine, whether it is the machine of Manhattan or the machine of the Bronx. It is the only hope of rescuing and saving our New York City.
Fiorella LaGuardia may have fired the first shot in the 1930s, but it wasn't until the 1960s that a real mechanism was set up to hold developers accountable for their promises to the people. The community boards. They fought different machines. They fought the bulldozers and cranes of the real estate developers. Outside Hudson Yards on New York's High Line, with cranes all around us, the people in the neighborhood affected by this mega project are making sure that their voices are heard. Dolores Rubin currently lives in the same building where she grew up, about 15 blocks from Hudson Yards. She's now the chair of Manhattan's Community Board Number 4.
People do not want to mess with Community Board 4. Very true.
Rubin's responsibility running one of the oldest and most aggressive community boards is to make sure that neighborhoods and communities have just as much say as any developer in a big project. So that when Sidewalk Labs CEO and Hudson Yards developer Dan Doktoroff called the area a blank slate with only 9 residences, Rubin pushes back.
I know that stat has been quoted many times by Dan Doktoroff. Our community board has disputed that because there are residences that are interspersed throughout this area and that do comprise the outskirts.
Dolores Rubin says she also wants a clearer idea of what's coming in. Tall buildings, she hears from Jessica Scaparotti. How tall, asks Dolores.
This is our smallest building, right? 52 stories, and on site it's the smallest.
For Hudson Yard specifically, our major concern is the height.
The people of the related companies and the city and the community board are now partners here. Dolores Rubin and other members of Community Board 4 are critics, but they now have a stake in the smart city's idea succeeding.
Smart city is holistic planning and futuristic planning. It's not about looking at the next 5 to 10 years. It's looking out 30 to 50 years. It's thinking about what is the demographic that you're going to attract with what you're building and how that may develop over that time. Will we need more school seats? Will we need additional firehouses? Will we need additional police so that you can accommodate a generation that will be in this particular neighborhood?
Which means building schools.
Which does mean building schools. This particular project was forward-looking enough to add a school within the master plan. There also were a lot of other very interesting things that were added. So, for example, they were thinking about how to solve a quality of life issue. Garbage. Our garbage is piled up on a street. They have used pneumatic tubes that will be running underneath some of these buildings to suck those garbage bags underneath out of sight for collection. That was very forward-thinking. And as we look at even further, where climate change will affect every large city, and we are on a river, which after Sandy, we recognize that this particular area is vulnerable when we didn't realize it was vulnerable. There was a lot of flooding through Chelsea, that the building needs to be smart as well as our environment shapes how we live.
What's the community board say about the fact that we're going to have tabs on everybody in this neighborhood? We got enough data to know who's shopping where, when, why, whose dog's being walked at what time. What's the community board say about that?
Well, even though privacy has been very much a hot topic in the last year, I would think that if you take a step back and think about what this data provides, it provides the information you need for better planning. It provides the information that you need to head off any potential concerns in the future. The community board is always seeking data. We happen to have many folks. Our previous chair, Christine Berté, was constantly gathering data and bringing that as evidence when we had developers come to say, this is what we're seeing in our neighborhood and here's the proof. And we make sure that it's not just an opinion or a feeling. It's backed by information that has been gathered, not just by us, but whoever gathers it. So there's not a concern overall about that data that's being gathered, because the data will be very, very helpful in improving the neighborhood overall. So I don't think that you will see much pushback from our particular community board. That does not mean that it doesn't create privacy concerns for others around the city.
People don't necessarily view the real estate wheelings and dealings in New York City as a democratic process, but you are the sort of outpost of democracy as part of the community board here. What's it like to face down some of these big players on some of the issues that you're concerned about?
Well, we're very lucky. Community Board 4's district, as I mentioned, is from 14th Street to 59th Street, 8th Avenue to the Hudson. It's a very large area that's had a lot of development. So the board itself has many longstanding members, so they're very familiar with the process. That helps, having people that are knowledgeable.
And but that's another way of saying people know not to mess with Community Board 4.
Yes, that's a very, very direct way of saying that people do not want to mess with Community Board 4. Very true. But one of the things that's been great in this process is because we're knowledgeable, we're not seen as an adversary or not seen as something that may derail or block a developer from bringing a vision together. What they see us as a partner. And also a litmus test. They'll come to our community board to go ahead and get an idea. Does this seem like a fit? What are some of the issues that the community may raise with this particular project, which is great. So there is a partnership. For Hudson Yard specifically, our major concern is the height. As we look around us right now, these buildings are very large, in large part out of character with some of the traditionally surrounding neighborhoods. We're going to see new buildings that have great amenities, that have incredible views, that are very modern. But we can't forget about the affordable housing stock that's already in existence, not just Chelsea Hell's Kitchen, but some of the surrounding areas right here, right on the periphery of Hudson Yards. This affordable housing stock have been buildings that are mostly low-rise, that have probably supported generations of family. These are at risk because as the properties around the Hudson Yards continue to crop up, and you do happen to have landlords who will take a look at this and see, how can I effectively renovate this property so that I can go ahead and turn it over? We may already see gentrification happening because of the property values around this area are skyrocketing as different businesses decide to come into this area. You happen to have restaurants that may come in or grocery stores that may come in that will cater to that higher price point. And that essentially prices out longstanding residents from their own neighborhoods.
Dolores Rubin is chair of Manhattan's Community Board Number 4. The plans are set. Cement has been poured at Hudson Yards. Well, the first, more commercial phase doesn't completely finish until 2018, when all the parks and plazas will open, including a statue that the developers are claiming will be New York's Eiffel Tower. More residential phase 2 will begin in 2020. That will be completed in 2025. Chairman of Related Companies, Stephen Ross.
This is just a preview of what's to come, but I think you can see the quality of what we're doing here and what our vision is of what the next great neighborhood or new city within the city in New York will actually become.
The first building in a new neighborhood, a city within a city, this time with sensors, fibers, pneumatic tubes, and visions. It's all just waiting for the people.
But thank you all, and we look forward to seeing you in the fall of 18 when we open up the plaza and the next buildings and the retail, and you'll really see Hudson Yards unfold as we really envision it.
You can go along with us on video to see our trip to Hudson Yards and what the project currently looks like. Just go to facebook.com/thetakeaway. And if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. Debate the smart city idea. Just have your friends listen to the podcast and argue with them. It's a great way to stay up on the news and have great conversations. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI. Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.